Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
That, of course, is the Talking Heads live version of the song iZimbra. Not even many Talking Heads fans know that the nonsense syllables David Byrne is singing there are from a poem by a man named Hugo Ball. He first recited them almost 100 years ago in Zurich, Switzerland. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, in for Chris Boyd, and we're talking today about what Hugo Ball helped start. Even before World War I began slaughtering millions of people for relatively little reason, a number of European artists thought we should hit the reset button on Western culture. But during the war, first in Zurich with Hugo Ball and others, then in Berlin, New York, and Paris, tiny groups of artists, often independently, began openly mocking not just the military and political insanity of their governments, but bedrock notions of our culture: order, reason, beauty, sanity, reality. This outbreak was called Dada, and it was a fitful, iconoclastic movement that still influences us today. My guest, Jed Rasula, is a distinguished professor of English at the University of Georgia. He's written several books of poetry and books on poetry. He's written a history of modernism, and his newest book is a narrative history of Dada called Destruction Was My Beatrice, Dada and the Unmaking of the 20th Century. Jed Rasula, welcome to Think.
It's nice to be here.
I'll start with what remains the simplest, hardest question. Consider your audience to be someone who knows of Dada, but only in the shorthand terms often used for it: anti-art, noisy performances, nonsense poems, yada yada, Dada. So define it. Describe it. What distinguished Dada from all the other avant-garde isms of that era, like Cubism or Expressionism?
Well, like Cubism, certainly, which was a movement that was named by someone outside the movement, the Dadaists actually named themselves and made a point of being proponents of the movement that they named, and also made a conspicuous public show of being against the movement itself. In one of the earliest manifestos of Dada by Richard Hülsenbeck, who was in Zurich when it started and then took the spark of Dada to Berlin. His first manifesto of Dada declared to be against this manifesto is to be a Dadaist. And so that kind of coil of contradiction is something that the Dadaists delighted in conveying to the public in all sorts of mischievous ways. But it also reflected the fact that they realized that they were starting out from a kind of an untenable position. They were all exiles from the combat nations in World War I. They had no cultural or institutional basis on which to proceed in doing anything at all. And they realized that their lack of power, their lack of ground, their not even being in their home countries was kind of an advantage in a way. It meant that they could behave with impunity and without looking over their shoulder wondering what, the good folks up on the hill thought about what they were doing.
So much about Dada was destructive, even gleefully so. It violently ignored ordinary rules of behavior or even comprehension. Tristan Tzara, one of the founders of Dada, would have several people on stage shout poems, often in different languages, all at once. The title of your book, Destruction Was My Beatrice, actually comes from the French poet Mallarmé, who wasn't a Dadaist but was one of their idols. Could you explain your title?
Well, the phrase that Mallarmé came up with, Destruction Was My Beatrice, was actually a confidential disclosure in a letter to a friend of his. Mallarmé in the 1870s had undergone a kind of spiritual crisis, and he was writing to a friend explaining the roots of this. And without getting into the roots of it and in terms of his own biography, the fruits of it were his extremely condensed elliptical poems that are just about as difficult to read as anything I think that anybody has committed to the printed page. And his disclosure in that letter was that simple phrase, destruction was my Beatrice. And Beatrice, of course, was the muse inspiring Dante, the Italian poet. And I think that what he was trying to signal by that is that creativity is always a positive thing in its own right, but it doesn't necessarily come from a kind of a positive beginning point. And he managed to figure out a way in which he could eliminate, or in his terms, destroy most of the going protocols and gestures of poetic speech and still end up with something called poetry. And that's why I adopted that as a title, because I thought it was a pretty good characterization of what the Dadaists themselves were against. They weren't kind of nihilistically out to just defy and destroy and make a nuisance of themselves. The world was already doing that in spades. And so they were interested in trying to figure out, how do you start again in the midst of all this mayhem? You know, there's a wonderful statement that Hugo Ball made that about the combatant nations in the war. He said, they cannot persuade us to enjoy eating the rotten pie of human flesh they present to us. I think that's a very succinct way of indicating that there was plenty of destruction going on elsewhere. So the kind of destruction that the Dadaists were after was to try to figure out how that level of general mayhem could be recuperated in some way and turned to productive uses, at least in art, although they were not strictly artists in the traditional sense either.
This was one of the surprises for me in reading your book. A lot of Dadaism, particularly what Tristan Tzara was up to, can seem juvenile, the kind of mocking pranks that college students might pull. And you yourself note that some Dada artists like Marcel Duchamp and Francis Picabia did have a degree of nihilism in their thinking. But it was a surprise to discover how many of the early Dadaists were actually motivated out of a sense of what could only be called spiritual renewal.
Yeah, that's certainly the case, although I would have to characterize that as part of the general artistic sensibility of that generation at the time. If you think of the fact that most of these people were born in the 1880s and the latest in the 1890s, Tristan Tzara was the youngest by almost a decade of the Dadaists, and he was born in 1896. But for people who came of age in the late 19th and early 20th century, it was a very spiritual time. It was a moment when Asian religions first started getting a lot of play in the West. It's a time when it was generally supposed that the function of the arts was to convey spiritual sentiments in some form or another. And one of the heroes of the Dadaists was the Russian artist living in Germany, Vasily Kandinsky. And Kandinsky was a theosophist. And his notion of art was that art literally conveyed pulsations from the spirit world through the organization of lines and colors. And Hugo Ball, for instance, was someone who lived in Munich before the war, was closely associated with Kandinsky, and kind of idolized the artist. And he was very much taken up in this sense that that the arts should be about spiritual renewal. Your reference to Tzara as being Tristan Tzara as being a kind of adolescent in a way is quite accurate, because being the youngest, he really was just a teenager when Dada originated in Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich in early 1916. Tzara was 19 at the time, and the others were in their late 20s. So there was a sense in which he was much closer to that adolescent prank stage of life. And in his case, it was something that never quite left him and that persisted at least throughout the run of Dada and contributed a very different perspective. The other people, I think, were a lot more serious in a way, less inclined to pranks, and his ability to keep adding that unsettling component to Dada activities is something that really helped get it off the ground.
That feeling of renewal beneath the destruction extended to things beyond the spiritual. There was even a sense that we reduce language into these kind of shouted syllables and things as a way of almost purifying it because the language had been so corrupted by politics. And it was true of everything gets reduced, the visual arts, sculpture, everything gets reduced to basic forms.
Yes, I think that's an aspect of Dada that really picks up on initiatives that were already underway in the visual arts and to a certain extent in literature even before Dada appeared. If you think of the work of Piet Mondrian, the Dutch artist, for instance, and the way in which in a matter of a few years he had gone from painting trees and ocean views to just producing grids of a few primary colors on his canvases. His whole orientation was to expose the kind of spiritual formation of human striving in horizontal and vertical lines. Now, that was a particular program of his. The Dadaists, on the other hand, were interested in discovering what the primary materials of creative activity might be in any form without regard to the priorities that had been established and were being maintained in art schools and things like that. So Hans Arp, for instance, who was one of the original participants in Zurich Dada, made a point with his partner and eventual wife, Sophie Teuber, of only using kind of raw materials for artworks and not practicing in the traditional elevated forms like oil painting. They repudiated oil paintings. And so they did a lot of work with fabrics, with found materials, with bits of driftwood that he would hammer together, things like that. Materials that art gallery and museum curators have now, over the last century, learned how to deal with in a curatorial way to preserve these perishable things. But at the time, nobody would have thought of just picking up something from the street and applying it to a canvas or nailing it to a piece of wood and having that be the basis for a work of art. And so the Dadaists were really very much about starting from scratch. I think that's really probably the most succinct way to put it.
And in that sense, starting over. This is, I mean, particularly true of someone like Kurt Schwitters, who literally used trash. Anything could be used to create art.
Yes, Schwitters is in some ways my favorite character, I think, of the entire motley crew of Dadaists, in part because he was a complete original and would have done whatever he ended up doing, I think, whether Dada had existed or not. And in fact, somewhat infamously, he tried to join the Dada movement in its Berlin formation and was refused access. The Berliners thought of him as being too bourgeois and too provincial. He was from the city of Hanover. And in the end, it didn't make any difference to him. He decided to just make his own quasi-Dada movement called Merz. And we can talk more.
We can come back to that. You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Jed Rezula, and we've been talking about Dada. Please join the conversation. You can call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org, and we'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks, in for Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is historian Jed Rezula, and we're talking about Dada. the wild and tiny art movement with a lasting influence. If you wish to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. You were talking about how Kurt Schwitters was ostracized by the Dadaists in Berlin. And in fact, that was something about Dada that was very distinctive, and that is that Dadaism was one thing in Zurich. In Berlin, it was much angrier and more political. And then in New York and Paris, it was cooler and more intellectual. Why was Dada so different from city to city?
The simple answer to that is really reflected in the organizational design that I had to come up with for the book, and that is that it was not consecutive. It's not like it started in one place and then conveniently went to this place and then that place and then the other place. Rather, it happened simultaneously and headed in different directions, I guess I would say. New York Dada, for instance. And there are several very good histories of New York Dada. The thing about New York Dada is that most of it happened before Dada originated in Switzerland in early 1916. So most of the so-called Dada activities in New York that involved Marcel Duchamp and Man Ray and the visiting French artist Francis Picabia, those things happened before any of them had heard about Dada because the Dadaists themselves had not named it yet. And so one of the peculiarities of writing a history of this movement is that I found I had to account for New York, and there are two chapters in the book on the New York scene, but one entire chapter actually has to precede the rise of Dada in Zurich in 1916. And one of the reasons why it was so different in each place is that Dada made a point of using, I guess, what I would call human carriers. There's a phrase that Tristan Tzara came up with to refer to Dada as a virgin microbe, and I like that phrase. It kind of suggests the way in which it just magically appeared in different places, although it was not strictly magical. As I mentioned earlier in the broadcast, Richard Hülsenbeck went literally in person from Zurich to Berlin in 1917 and told the Berlin artists that he knew already there about what had gone on at Cabaret Voltaire in Zurich. So there was a kind of direct transmission there. But in other cases, people found out about it second or third hand. Max Ernst, for instance, who later became more famous as a surrealist in Paris, Max Ernst was living in Cologne at the time. He had been a friend of Hans Arp before the war, but because of the war circumstance, they'd been out of touch. And at some point, he found out that his friend, Hans Arp, was involved in something called Dada in Zurich. He had not heard of it before, and this is after the war was over, so several years after Dada had already completely concluded in Zurich. So It spread by word of mouth, innuendo, press reports, and a lot of deliberate misinformation. One of the things that the Dadaists really pioneered, I think, as cultural figures, was planting false reports in the press. And they did this with abandon and gleefully every place that they were. And part of it is just a reflection of the different milieu. I mean, nowadays it would be much more difficult for people to plant the kind of misinformation in the press. But maybe the more accurate thing today is to say that on the internet you can get away with anything. And the internet in those days was journalism. And clearly the Dadaists realized 100 years ago that in the public press you could get away with anything.
That struck me as a kind of a paradox in early Dada, one that today's more cynical art industry seems to revel in. And that is, Dada artists often enjoyed taking on the techniques of advertising, using the images, the lettering, the phrases, and subverting them, mocking commercialism or capitalism in general. Yet rarely has any group of artists tried so hard in so many ways to market themselves especially the way Tristan Tzara and others did, driving around trucks, handing out flyers, as you said, planting stories in newspapers. It seemed there's tremendous energy to try to get attention.
Well, I think it was, on the one hand, you're absolutely right that they were trying to garner attention, public notice in some way. But the other thing is that that Dada, in a crucial sense, started as a movement against the compliance of journalism with the war effort. The thing that all of the Dadaists were unanimous about, despite their many, many differences, is that all of them found it absolutely criminal the way in which the press just basically laid down and went belly up like a dog waiting to have its belly rubbed in the presence of the war effort. And they thought that the press had been criminally negligent in supporting and fanning the flames of a kind of nationalism that meant that entire populations were blinded to really thinking seriously about what it meant to engage in this kind of trench warfare on the Western Front. And so their way of responding was to use the press against itself in a way. And this is something that in one of the earliest, I think, and most accurate appraisals of Dada was written by the American poet Ezra Pound, really while it was still going on. And in a letter to the American journal The Dial in, I think, 1920, Pound wrote this. He said, "The Dadaists have satirized the holy church of our century, journalism. They have satirized the sanctimonious attitude towards the arts, irrespective of whether the given work of art contains a communication of intelligence. And they have given up the pretense of impartiality." I think those are very astute observations, especially his sense that the intelligent mind somehow perches on a kind of a cliff of Buddhist indifference to the world. When he says they've given up the pretense of impartiality, it's a way of saying that they'd rolled up their sleeves and they were ready for a fight.
The fight they had was something of a paradox. Dada is often called anti-art. It's an easy catchphrase, but Dada wasn't so much against all art as against certain safe, comfortable, middle-class notions of art, and, of course, sometimes against the other avant-garde artists in the vicinity. But as you point out in your book, Dada was in a paradoxical battle using culture to undermine culture.
Yes, that's it. It's the traditional problem of bootstrapping. If you're approaching any problem from outside a position of delegated authority, how do you go about your business? How do you make a claim for the applicability of your skills, your expertise? Or how do you make a claim for somebody's attention if you are not claiming it on the basis of expertise and skill? In fact, this is something that all of us deal with all the time in our lives. You know, every conversation is kind of predicated on the sense that, all right, I'll give you, a few minutes of my time. I'll listen to what you have to say, but, and I'm going to listen to you not because I know that you're authorized to speak on this or that subject, but just because, we're having a conversation. And the Dadaists, I think, raise that kind of everyday principle of common exchange to a very different level, and at the same time deposed some of the bugbears and the false idols that had been erected in the public sphere, especially in the sphere of the arts. The Dadaists would have been absolutely alarmed about the current state of the arts, for instance, in which almost the only thing that you read about the arts in say the New York Times or other papers of record are the kind of prices that works sell for, rather than the perspective that is presented or the what the artist is actually doing. It's all about the market rather than the art, and that's something that Dada took aim at 100 years ago.
What I've been calling paradoxes in Dada, and also what we earlier mentioned about the differences in Dada from city to city, were also exacerbated, I suppose, by extremely strong and sometimes divisive personalities involved. It's not just in your history, but in many histories, if you read far enough, almost no one has anything good to say about André Breton, who starts off as a Dadaist, of course, and then becomes this kind of surrealist tyrant.
Well, there are all sorts of necessarily wonderful things about Breton, but he did have a kind of a controlling personality right from the beginning, a magnetic personality, I guess you would say. The groups of aspiring young Parisian writers at the time that Dada came to Paris used to gather around Breton's table at the Café Certa, which is in one of the old arcades in the city and was subsequently torn down around 1920. And it was just a sign of his personality that people liked to listen to him pass judgment on affairs of uncultural affairs. He had a very sharp eye for art. He survived just barely by selling artworks to particular clients. He didn't have a gallery or anything like that. So it was really just kind of like a rare book scout in some way. He'd find things and then figure out who he could sell them to. But it's really only in the later phases of Dada, when it arrived in Paris, that he started, that André Breton, I think, was infected by the bug of aspiration in a way. He really wanted to make Dada into a movement. He wanted to make he wanted originally to have Tzara be the leader of the movement, but after a while Breton realized that Tzara just wanted to keep doing in Paris what he had already done in Zurich several years earlier. And that was probably an accurate assessment on Breton's part. And so he was frustrated with it and gradually started to feel rankled by the dominance of Tzara. And out of that conflict between the two of them and between many other people that's hardly worth mentioning on radio, the Surrealist movement was born out of those ashes. And one of the unfortunate side effects of that is that Dada and Surrealism have been joined at the hip practically ever since in a whole series of major museum retrospectives. Museum of Modern Art had major retrospectives on Dada and Surrealism together in the 1940s and then again in the 1960s. And that has led to this sense that somehow you always have to deal with both of them at the same time. And that really is not the case. It was only in Paris, after all, that Surrealism and Dada had any relation to one another. And
we have an email from Ellis in North Dallas who writes, "I briefly studied Dada in college in New York back in the late 1940s. I remember speaking with people who had attended their art exhibits in Paris and Berlin. One gentleman described a Paris art exhibit which featured a urinal and a young lady in a communion dress singing dirty songs, or a lecture, in quotation marks, by Thomas Craven in New York. When asked to define Dada, he began tearing off his clothes and shouting obscenities. Dada made use of and elevated society's rejects."
That's an interesting email. It actually conflates three different exhibitions in three different places, but all of them are worth noting. In the reference to the young girl reading obscene poems, that actually happened in Cologne at the first Dada exhibition that Max Ernst put together. And the entryway was through the back of a beer hall. So in order to get entrance to the exhibition space, you'd have to go past the toilet and past the area where the garbage was accumulated. And it was right there that a girl, kind of a probably a 12, 13-year-old girl wearing a communion outfit was reading or reciting obscene poems. And the urinal, of course, was Marcel Duchamp's found art object, which he named Fountain. And that was not actually exhibited. It was submitted for exhibition at the Independence, which was an art organization that had been created by Duchamp with several New York artists. And he submitted it under a pseudonym, R. Mutt, M-U-T-T, that was painted on the side of the urinal or on the rim of the urinal, like an artist's signature. And the jury, even though this was an exhibition and in which to be have your work exhibited, all you had to do was to pay a fee, and then it was exhibited, no questions asked. There was no jury in that sense. But once Duchamp had pseudonymously paid the admission fee and submitted his urinal, several of the other members of the jury said, no, there's no way in that we're going to allow this monstrosity to be displayed in public. And so the urinal actually disappeared after that. It was never found again, but it was photographed by the great American photographer Alfred Stieglitz. And that's the earliest evidence of its existence.
But Duchamp went on and made duplicates later, didn't he, signing them?
He spent the rest of his life authorizing duplicates.
in that way, isn't Duchamp sort of the most destabilizing of all the Dada artists, with the kind of intellectual conundrum that art is nothing more than what the artist says it is?
Well, it's in Duchamp's case, it's a little more complicated than that, just because he had a personal mission to overcome what he thought of as the inherent stupidity of art, which is its immersion in the material world, relying on the eye. He wanted art to be cerebral, very cerebral and conceptual. So that's really what he was about more than anything else.
You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Jerome Weeks in for Chris Boyd. We're talking about Dada, and we'll be back right after these messages.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Messieurs, les ex-dadas sont priés de venir manifester et surtout de crier « Abba Satie, Abba Picabia, vive la nouvelle revue française !»
That's from a recording of works by the French composer Eric Satie. You probably know him best as the writer of Les Trois Gymnopédies, his lovely piano works. That's a recreation of an announcement for a ballet performed in Paris in 1924, written by the Dada artist Francis Picabia, who also did the set designs, with music by Satie. My name is Jerome Weeks. I'm in for Chris Boyd, and this is Think, and we are talking about Dada with Jed Rizzulla. If you wish to join our conversation, please call 800-933-5372 or email us at think@kera.org. Jed, if I have one complaint about your book, Destruction Was My Beatrice, it would be the lack of Dada's influence on music. But we actually don't know what the earliest Dada live performances sounded like, do we? All those banging on pans and things.
That's true. We have descriptions of the kind of materials that were used to make sounds. And it's clear that sounds, making sounds rather than making music, was really more the point of orientation. But I'm glad you brought up Satie, because Satie would be the closest to an actual composer who participated at one remove, in a certain way, with Dada. Otherwise, the Dadaists were not really involved with music. There were not musicians among their ranks, per se. At Cabaret Voltaire, Hugo Ball, the founder of the cabaret and one of the founders of the Dada movement. He played piano. He played a kind of honky-tonk or ragtime piano as well as little snippets of classical music for the clientele there. So he was a moderately accomplished musician. And later on in a tour of Holland that was undertaken by Kurt Schwitters with the editor of Die Stijl magazine, Theo van Doesburg, the two of them traveled around with Van Doesburg's wife, Nellie, who was an actual accomplished classical musician, pianist. And so there was music on those occasions as well. But for the most part, the Dadaists were simply not involved with trying to extend the principle of Dada into music. And that's one reason why I found that the more important musical profile associated with Dada is the appearance of jazz. Jazz, like Dada, was something that appeared in the world in the middle of the First World War. And like Dada, nobody really knew what jazz was. So it was known through rumor and innuendo and supposition long before anybody had actually heard any jazz musicians. And because of that, jazz and Dada were often associated, especially in Europe. And once the Dadaists realized that there was this phenomenon in the world called jazz, they started just dropping the word into advertisements for their public events, even though they didn't know what jazz was either. But they figured it was a good way of writing ad copy for a performance.
To visiting European artists in New York, America was already so radically modern, so aggressively mechanical and automotive and filled with jazz that to some it was as if America already was Dada. Could you explain?
Certainly the sense that the United States, American culture, behaved with indifference to the whole framework of references that prevailed in Europe is something that really excited and titillated Europeans, not just the Dadaists who came to the United States. Now, there's a long tradition of Europeans coming to the United States and having nothing but dismissive things to say about it, scoffing at its lack of culture, its lack of traditional values and so forth. But for most Europeans who were coming, especially in the early 20th century, and especially to New York or Chicago, where there were skyscrapers, it was just like landing on the moon or landing on Mars or something. They could not believe what they were encountering. And it kind of fortified their sense that they didn't need to just mindlessly hang on to European values just because they were old or just because they were traditional.
Recreation was possible.
Yeah, or just starting from scratch, to return to that phrase that we talked about a little while ago.
If Dada didn't actually invent the following things, it certainly popularized them and made them persistent factors in contemporary culture. Performance art, conceptual art, pop art, op art, installation art, the photomontage, randomness in art, the dissolution between high and low cultures. But it seems to me that if anything, the real scourge that Dada has left us with is the artist's statement, the manifesto. Rarely have any artist made so many public manifestos. I counted 5 references to Tristan Tzara issuing a manifesto, for instance, in your book. why?
Well, the art of the manifesto is something that was already fully formed and widely practiced by the time Dada came along. And in some sense, the roots of the manifesto go back to Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels and the Communist Manifesto a half a century before Dada appeared. Manifestos started being issued by artists and groups of artists in the 1880s and 1890s in Paris and in other places. And by the time the Italian Futurist movement was launched in 1909, It was the Italian futurists who really pioneered the art of the manifesto. They could hardly let a day go by without issuing a manifesto about something, you know, whether it was hygiene or any other topic that they wanted to address. And so the Dada orientation to manifestos was very much one of following in an established line, particularly the line that had been pioneered by the futurists. The difference with the Dadaists is that they recognized that a manifesto could point in a couple different directions. If you think of the futurist manifestos as being like one-way streets with a solid arrow pointing in one direction unambiguously, destroy the museums and statements like that. The Dadaist manifesto is just a farrago of contradictions. And so it's really impossible to read any of the Dadaist manifestos and to come away with a sense of having read a coherent doctrine about anything.
It seemed to me that the purpose of so many manifestos was to distinguish me from the other guy. And yet, as you say, Dada manifestos were clearly known by their self-contradictions, but they are, in effect, self-destructive manifestos.
Yes, I think that's a very good way to put it. The Dada manifesto would have, I mean, this is reversing chronology, but the Dada manifesto is kind of like those, I'm thinking way back to that television show Mission Impossible when the protagonist would hear the recording that was self-destructed after it played and said, should you choose to accept this assignment, do this or do that. Dadaist manifestos were like that in the same way, especially because so many of them were actually read in public. And so, to hear anything that's internally contradictory like that, read in public, always confronts the public with a kind of a confusing, did I miss something? Was I not paying attention there? Was I dozing off? And the Dadaists took advantage of that, the fact that you could pay the closest possible attention, like you were reading Kant or Hegel or something, but you still would not be able to follow it.
I thought that was one of the more bizarre things about the Dada performances is that they would contain visual works of art. They would contain shouted poetry, bits of what might constitute music, but also reading of manifestos. And I realized that the Dada artists were often fascinated with what might be considered low culture. But it seemed to me that they had created a really perverse form of vaudeville that involved the reading of manifestos from the stage.
Again, this is a practice that they quite literally learned from the Italian futurists, who did all of those same things. Your characterization of the performance makes me want to add something to this that is very particular to your listening area, which is an installation that was. Put into motion because of what I'm about to describe here, at the Dallas Contemporary Museum earlier this year. Mm-hmm. I was in Dallas a couple months ago and was able to see this installation by a French artist named Laurie Gréot, and the title of the installation is the Unplayed Notes Museum. And it's an installation that consists of a lot of artworks through this rather big space at the Dallas Contemporary. And there's a little booklet to go with it, and there are a lot of complicated plaques in an invented language on the wall that sort of make it – that solicit your attention but then thwart it immediately because you can't really read it. And then the space is filled with works that have literally been pulverized into fragments. And I talked to a curator when I was at the museum and I asked about this. And apparently at the opening, which was on January, 19th of this year, all of the people there with champagne glasses in hand for the opening night were suddenly interrupted by a bunch of they didn't know this, but they were interrupted by a bunch of hired actors who started assaulting the artworks and destroyed 10% of what was up in the museum space. And everything about this phenomenon, this combination of museum and performance struck me as being obviously derivative of, but in an interesting way, I thought, from Dada, the sense that there are no reliable boundaries here. You might be at an art opening and suddenly somebody's going to start destroying the art that you've come to see.
When you were in Dallas, I don't suppose you swung by Club Dada.
No.
We have one, and it's been around for a long time, actually.
I did come across a reference to it, but I couldn't figure out where it was.
it's a secret. As you mentioned earlier, Dada in Paris eventually morphed into surrealism, and it also morphed into constructivism. And of course, there were specific reasons, specific personalities involved, but you do get the sense of Dada being something of a dead end, that Tristan Tzara, for instance, couldn't keep doing the same thing.
It's true. It's a conjunction of two different forces: dead end versus new beginning, and because of the rather impromptu and location-specific activities that had been generated by Dada in each of its key locales, whether that be Zurich or Berlin or Cologne or Hanover or New York or Paris, because those things were all so particular to a place at a particular time, it was hard even for the Dadaists to try to imagine what to do next. And in most cases, and Tristan Tzara is the real exemption from this, in most cases they were not particularly committed to perpetuating Dada as it had been in the past. And they realized that it had a salutary impact in the world at the time that it appeared, but it was kind of like a guerrilla action. You can't sustain a guerrilla action in perpetuity. And I think they recognized that. And so surrealism grew out of it somewhat organically, even if with a lot of interpersonal conflicts in Paris. And the more pervasive phenomenon in Eastern Europe and in Germany was constructivism, which was a movement that had largely been associated with the Soviet Union in the early years, right after the Bolshevik Revolution. And the basic principle was that what had the skills that had formerly been applied to making art should be applied instead to remaking society. And that's, I think, was one of the reasons why most of the German Dadaists happily subscribed to that as the post-war environment presented a world that needed to be recreated.
We've been talking with Jed Rasula, the author of a new history of Dada called Destruction Was My Beatrice, Dada in the Unmaking of the 20th Century. Jed, thanks for talking with us today. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. We had help on the phones today from Jose Carrion. You can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Jerome Weeks, in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.